want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to the very latest from peterbcollins.com. We're supported by listeners who subscribe, and we like to name names. Miko Silvanoinen, James Swift, Sally Soriano, and Nicholas Yaksich. Thank you for your support. And if you're so inclined, just drop by my website at peterbcollins.com. The links to sign up for a subscription are right under my photograph on the upper left-hand side of the homepage. Before the end of this podcast, Will Durst will check in with his satirical look at the NSA and the leaks attributed to Ed Snowden. But each week across the summer, we hope to bring you a recap of the Bradley Manning court-martial proceedings at Fort Meade, Maryland, with journalist Kevin Gostola, who is live blogging the events daily at firedoglake.com. Kevin, welcome back. How are you doing today?
Excellent. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, and once again, you have to work hard for 3 days, and then Judge Denise Lind has recessed the court-martial proceedings last week on Thursday and Friday, and this week again. Were the reasons similar, that the next round of witnesses were not in place near the Beltway?
The first one I heard from a public affairs officer was there's a storm coming, and they didn't want to have court yesterday. I guess maybe there was some kind of a threat to the area. I've heard a little bit about some damage in the region around Fort Meade, but I'm not sure if that's exactly a good explanation for the entire reason why we are not having court again till Monday. And I think it's just because we are moving really quickly in this proceeding. I think that we have more witnesses who are stipulating, and for people who are new to this process, that involves the prosecution and the defense deciding that this witness is going to give this testimony no matter what. We agree to this testimony. Let's just put it down in writing and we'll enter it into the record. And I think that they are doing that with a number of witnesses. I believe they've done it for over 20 witnesses so far, at least. So that cuts down on the fact that we were going to hear from about, we could have heard from 130 to 150 witnesses testifying from the stand. And it's looking like that will not be the case.
Mm-hmm. Now, this decision to shift from live testimony to a stipulation, is that made in advance or kind of on the fly? Because, again, you would think that these are things that could be worked out in advance, and then the scheduling of actual live witness testimony would be separate from the stipulators.
From what I'm seeing, it appears that it could go both ways. That you could prepare ahead of time, but it's not uncommon for it to happen on the fly because the defense and the prosecutors can come to these determinations. I also think that there's an element here, and this is me projecting some of my views, but this is sort of a fair assumption given what I've seen all along the way during the court-martial, which is that the prosecutors want to put on a show. I think that they're very much planned and prepared to have this trial and wanted to do it before the world to prosecute Bradley Manning. And I think that some of them want to do cross-examinations of these witnesses And the defense is saying, no, you don't have to have this guy waste our time testifying. We know what he's going to say. We don't, you know, we don't have any problem with what he's going to say. Let's just put it down in the record, and the judge can have it for whatever decision she's going to make about whether Bradley Manning is guilty of committing any of these offenses. And then the prosecutors will get upset, and they'll tell the judge that, no, we don't want to stipulate. We've had stipulations in court, by the way, that weren't just, you know, let's go into a room and decide on this in writing. We've had them on the fly, because what happens is, and this is sort of going into the weeds here, but you'll have these situations in court where people will just be put up on the stand as experts. And you can spend any time between, you know, like 20, 30, 40 minutes hearing from these individuals as they talk about their knowledge of cybersecurity terms or computer terminology, or try to prove that they're in fact digital experts. And the defense will say, we don't dispute that this guy knows what he's talking about and that he works in this field. And the prosecutor will say, no, 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 we're laying at a foundation. We need to waste time and make you listen to 40 minutes of us quizzing him on his dictionary knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So with these stipulations, is it just submitted to the court? Are portions read aloud so that the testimony is heard by both teams and spectators? You know, is this meaningful part of the record, or is it just kind of boilerplate stuff that gets filed away?
It's not secret. It's available. It's actually posted online to something they call the Freedom of Information Act Reading Room. I have access to it as a reporter. I think the public can go to this page, although I will caution that they seem to have some kind of feature built into this room, and I haven't quite figured out exactly what it's doing, but I can tell you that when I went there with my web browser, I believe I was using something like either Mozilla or Chrome. I can't remember exactly, but all that matters is when I went there, I got a warning about the website that it might be malicious and I should watch out, which just basically told me that they have some kind of tracking mechanism in their reading room so they can see who is reading these documents, which is a problem in and of itself. I just think that that suggests that they're spying on the reporters who are pulling these documents, and that should not be allowed.
Well, you're certainly right, but it's not at all surprising that they would do
it
that.
It isn't. That, you know, and we're talking about Fort Meade, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the Army, well aware that they would want to do this kind of tracking. But I guess it's just to let you know that if you get that message, that's all that's going on. And so maybe you would decide to go ahead and just pull the documents. I mean, hey, if they know you were there and you're reading them, then maybe they'll know that we're not making this all up, that there is public interest, or that people want to actually look at these documents. Because to a certain extent, I feel like they're giving us lip service sometimes when they repeat these things as if it's not something that people actually want to have access to these documents. So it's to your main point, they're not secret. They are read into the record. We hear every single word. If it happens to be classified, there has been some classified stipulating. We won't know, but we'll get the unclassified stuff will come out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the procedure and how it will work throughout the rest of the trial.
So you had 3 days of testimony punctuated by these stipulated submissions of testimony. And what did you see as the highlights of the 3 days of session this week in the Bradley Manning court-martial?
Yes, and I do want to say that I'm going to begin to do weekly wrap-ups. It's something I didn't do last week, but I'm working on one that I'll run tomorrow morning.
Mm-hmm.
On Saturday. So anyone who's listening can look for that. Just to digest so people can tell, because I think this week was much more difficult than the previous week to pull out what exactly were the, you know, the key developments that I think are worth paying attention. The first thing that I found to be remarkable was seeing the, and this is actually on a positive note, seeing the defense for Bradley Manning finally step up and acknowledge that they wanted to be part of this effort worldwide to have greater press freedom and to actually stand in the court and tell the judge that we support the crowd-funded stenographers that the Freedom of the Press Foundation have sent here. We think that it'll help Bradley Manning's Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial be protected. We think it will also protect the First Amendment rights that the press have and the public have for access to the trial and to cover it. And apparently, through their involvement and then even the judge's involvement, the government has been ordered or instructed to make sure that the stenographers that were funded by the Freedom of the Press Foundation are given access. And there can be no excuses. If the media center is filled with reporters, which I think will be highly unusual, although I do expect it to be full for closing arguments, we've thinned out considerably for an array of reasons. If it is full to capacity, they have to give them access to an overflow trailer, which also has a feed, and they're allowed to bring their equipment into this trailer and do their job. So there's no more obstructing of these stenographers, and they are supposed to be able to do what they want to do.
And Kevin, my only addition here would be, I think that I appreciate what the Freedom of the Press Foundation is doing in providing the stenographers and the transcripts and the crowdfunding. They're raising money to do that. But I do think if they're posted online, there should be a special paywall that only applies to the corporate media outlets because they should not be able to steal your work at Fire Dog Lake or the detailed work of the stenographers because they're too lazy to actually show up at the trial.
Yes, I agree. And I have heard, actually experienced, New York Times journalists asking for information about the proceedings so they don't have to be there mm-hmm. on days. And that is a problem. But I also do think that we should recognize that this sort of transparency happens in the court systems all the time. I've written about the Guantanamo military commissions without being down there
yep.
because they have a system for posting records that the military does not have this system for posting records related to court martials is just a statement of how much they prize secrecy and how much they want to operate in a closed manner and control everything, basically take care of their own and not have you or I involved in commenting or paying close attention if they don't have to.
Mm-hmm. All right, so in addition to the court's recognition of the stenographer and the access issue, what else came up that you thought was significant this week?
All right, so transitioning to actual developments that will impact Bradley Manning's case, what we had happen was a situation where the defense was able to pin down with a good cross-examination of a forensic examiner. His name is Special Agent David Shaver, and he was one of the people who got to see all these logs and all of these electronic records that came from the hardware that he was using. So we're talking about Manning's personal computers and the different connections to government servers and the downloads and transfer logs. This is kind of technical, but just to get that out there to establish, this man has a lot of access to the materials to answer these questions. And Shaver gave the defense the ability to prove that this Guarani video, we're talking about there was an airstrike in the Farah province of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Over 100 civilians were killed. It was soundly condemned by human rights organizations. I think they even equated it to Judgment Day. And Bradley Manning was believed to have provided a video from this investigation into the strike to WikiLeaks. The prosecutors had claimed that an individual working at Brookhaven National Laboratory, his name's Jason Katz, they had claimed that he had been part of this kind of conspiracy working on decrypting this video so that WikiLeaks could publish and share it. And what the defense was able to prove is that there is absolutely no connection with this person, Jason Katz, at all. There's no forensic evidence linking Bradley Manning to him. There is no conspiracy in the sense that one of the aspects of the prosecutor's arguments have been that Bradley Manning immediately began to pilfer, steal, purloin, whatever word you want to use, take government documents from the network when he first entered the military and was deployed in Iraq in November. And they said, or have claimed, that he released this Guarani video to WikiLeaks in November. But there is no evidence that he ever made any kind of transmission. In fact, Bradley said during his plea statement in February that he would be willing to plead guilty to transmitting this video they were talking about in April, that he would admit to coming across it in April. But because they want so badly to make it seem like he was working much earlier on in his deployment for WikiLeaks, they would not accept that plea.
So then, did the prosecution take a hit to its credibility by trying to assert the wrong date of when Manning had access to this video and may have uploaded it to WikiLeaks? And it's important to note, I think I have this correct, that WikiLeaks never released this particular video.
Yeah, we've never seen this. And in fact, the video that they were trying to decrypt was a flyover video. It's not actually a video from the strike. It's not showing carnage like the collateral murder video. What we've heard in the court proceedings is that it was a flyover video that was from this investigation folder. Maybe somebody surveying the scene afterwards during an investigation. So if it was released, it would have been nothing. It would have been a dud. And there is another video file different from the one that he's charged with releasing that he would say he pulled from the server and possibly handed over to WikiLeaks. But what we're seeing here is that if people are looking, there's a charge sheet online. If anybody wants to follow along at home, it's specification 11 of charge 2, and you can read the legalese. And I do think that the prosecutors are experiencing a situation where the charge could be tossed out for multiple reasons, which we'll get to in a moment. But I'll start with the first one, which is just that it does not appear that he compromised this file. So I don't know how you can charge him for it. If you also have the date wrong, I don't know if you can charge him for that. But there's also issues with dates for the other charges. The prosecutors have their own sets of dates, and the defense has their own sets of dates. And I have not been too incredibly certain about what this does to Bradley Manning and what is going to happen here as the defense and prosecutors go back and forth. It hasn't been clear to me, since I'm not going to claim to be a military justice or a legal expert. I don't know why those dates being different, if that makes it possible for the defense to say Bradley Manning's less guilty or what, because he's still committing the offenses. But what I have said is that I think it goes to this larger thing of conspiracy and committing espionage and aiding the enemy. And if you can make it seem that his intentions were not conspiring on behalf of WikiLeaks, then I think that can go a long way towards reducing the possibility of a harsh sentence.
Well, Kevin, my observation from this great distance is that it may be minor, but that if the defense is able to throw off the prosecution on the narrative that they offer, it could undermine, and you're suggesting that, that one specific charge may be thrown out because there isn't sufficient evidence to make it stick. And so on a cumulative basis, it may have a beneficial impact for the Manning defense team.
And I largely agree with that. I think that you're getting to see how some parts of the prosecutor's case is just hackneyed. I mean, it's just, you know, kind of they're making it up as they go because they don't have the evidence to back up some of the more harsh allegations they want to make. And so they'll toss in circumstantial evidence about reports or documents that the Army maybe put together. And then they'll say, because there's something in that document that says this happened, that then that makes Bradley Manning guilty of committing that charge when there isn't any connection. So I guess we could roll into the fact that we did have a woman who took the stand this week. She was involved in the process of putting together a report by the Army Counterintelligence Center that had a, as its heading, what the document was about was the threat, the alleged threat that the military thought that WikiLeaks posed to the United States Army. But I want to caution people and say that what I found out in this testimony was that it was a self-initiated report, which means that nobody from up on high was saying, we think WikiLeaks is a threat. And we basically had two or three analysts within the division doing what is fairly normal, but deciding on their own that we've got a little bit of information that suggests this group, WikiLeaks.org, this website, might be a place where the enemy would go for U.S. government information, including classified information. They might even go there. If you're a foreign intelligence agency or a foreign security service, they might go there. So we should give this a little closer look. And they published this report that WikiLeaks ended up disclosing because Manning provided a copy. And the title was WikiLeaks.org, an online reference to foreign intelligence services, insurgents, or terrorist groups, ? So it was a question. They weren't sure. In fact, it was an intelligence gap that they were not able to confirm that this was so, but the prosecutors have presented this report as if it is incontrovertible proof that enemies were using the WikiLeaks website. Now, the defense properly showed that this woman, Sheila Glenn, who is a career intelligence officer, had no way to confirm that this was a website enemies were going to. And we talked a little bit about this last week, that the defense has pursued this line, making sure that a lot of the witnesses that make claims about the way that WikiLeaks could have been used, making sure that they poke holes in that and show that they don't definitively know. And you have no evidence, then you can't charge Manning with aiding the enemy because there's no way that he could have definitively known. I'll let you jump in. I'm sure you have a couple questions about this.
Well, let me come back for a minute to Jason Katz and the way you describe. I'm looking at the live blog post about this, and you say prosecutors alleged that he had video from the FARA investigation on his computer that was allegedly provided by Manning, but they can't connect it to Manning in any way. So here is one charge leveled by the government that appears to have been proven false. And in a criminal court, in a conventional court in the United States, if the prosecution presents a series of spurious charges, it will enrage the judge and can lead to contempt. But my perception in the military proceeding is that there's no real penalty to the prosecution for piling on, and just seeing at the end of the day what sticks. So is there any sanction to the prosecution for bringing spurious charges that are flushed out right before the court.
I just think that there's this, you know, everyone accepts as a standard that in order to be convicted of something, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt that you committed the offense. And the defense attorneys of Bradley Manning are doing a pretty good job of creating this idea in the mind of the judge that there is a lot of reason to doubt that this offense was ever committed. And so I think that also given the fact that she has 21 other charges before her that she can convict Manning of, and there are also lesser offenses which she has pled guilty to committing, it's a good likelihood that she says, well, I don't want to be challenged on appeal, so let's just toss this charge out because it doesn't have much behind it. And then we'll go with the other charges and the ones that have substantial evidence and proof so that, and then, you know, I'm not suggesting that he's going to get off easy because they're having difficulties here. But I think the offenses where where you can prove that the prosecutors don't have evidence, I'm pretty sure that the judge isn't going to go out on a limb and just try to, you know, just say guilty because she could know that there might be a situation created by that, like an appeal.
So, Kevin, there's a post at 5:30 p.m. that day. It says the press was informed by a public affairs officer that it's wrong to display emotion when the prosecutors appear to be unable to prove that Manning committed the offense as charged. What was the reaction that they had to tamp down?
Well, my fellow colleague, her name's Alexa O'Brien. She's done a lot of work putting out a public record during the pretrial process so everyone could see what was happening all along the way since we had secrecy. And she happened to throw her hands up in the air and cheer because she was excited that the defense had just proven that what the prosecutors had been claiming was false. And we had an officer who is actually new say to us that this is not a sporting event. And so he's now become the butt of jokes within the media center collectively.
I'll just amend that to tell you that I have occasionally been permitted into the press box at football or professional baseball games. And they have a no cheering rule there. So even at sporting events, there are people who aren't supposed to cheer. But that's a really interesting sidebar. Now, Kevin, the other impression I have from your live blogging of these 3 days of proceedings this week is that the prosecution is going to microscopic lengths to establish as many elements that they can to create the sense that there was aiding of the enemy. So, for example, I saw a reference to testimony about the collateral murder video, and that by releasing it, because there are scenes visible in the cockpit of the settings on some of the instruments, and that this reveals to an enemy the protocols and the, you know, maybe the altitude of the helicopter, the angle of the shots that were fired. And while, you know, that may have some validity, at the same time, it's a forest for the trees situation. Because Manning didn't release that video so that people could look at the cockpit of the helicopter. He released the video because of the craven murders that were committed by the helicopter gunship with the collusion of the commanders who were communicating with it by radio.
So here's where I have to just put out a general caution, because this was stipulated to by the defense, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they agree with the sense of this person's testimony, mainly just that this is what that person was going to say. So I just want everybody who's listening to this podcast to not think the defense is necessarily accepting this interpretation of the risk posed by the collateral murder video, because they will, in their closing arguments and also when they get to put on their case, bring people forward to testify about how this information possibly didn't reveal those things, or that maybe those things that are claimed to have been in the video were already known to a point.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to focus on is exactly what you're saying. So they'll tell you that tactics, techniques, and procedures were put at risk. But this goes to generally the problem in the rising, expanding, always expanding national security state that so desires to be able to operate in total secrecy, that they will tell you that you can't release this because it has sources or methods, or you're going to find out tactics, techniques, or operating principles, or you're going to reveal these sort of things that the enemy could seize upon in order to come back and attack the United States. And what you have to say back to that, the response has to be that if it's illegal, if it's inhumane, if it happens to be evidence of a war crime, like torture, you can't keep this information secret. You should not be allowed to cover up this information and conceal it, because that is not covered by law. It's actually technically not covered by secrecy regime, although they still would protect this material. But when you have evidence that individuals are being killed, that there wasn't any... now, the problem here, though, is that the military did their own investigation and decided that the rules of engagement were followed. But then, you know, that makes the other problem, which is that the military gets to decide if its soldiers have committed crimes. And obviously, they're going to cover as much as possible for them if they do want to go back and say that they, you know, nothing happened, nothing was wrong. I mean, I think after this video was released, you had them do this kind of a put on a show and look to see if, in fact, those people in the video were victims of a crime. And they not surprisingly decided that there wasn't any crime, which is what you would expect from the military.
Yeah. So is that what you see occurring here, kind of a thousand cuts, an attempt to find every possible way of suggesting or proving that Manning should have known or did know that his release of this information to WikiLeaks would compromise these issues in some way?
Yes. I think that they've got a fairly extensive, comprehensive case that they've put together, and I think that they have circumstantial evidence that I would say the defense might have a tough time entering into the court if they were coming at it from the opposite angle. So you could have someone get up there and testify about going to a conference with the Chaos Computer Club and how he put together his own independent report or assessment on WikiLeaks. This is separate from the other report that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And he can talk about his experience hearing what was said and why he thought that that might be some kind of a threat to the military. And I think it might feed into... I think Bradley in the chat logs with hacker and government informant Adrian Lamo that he had mentioned the Chaos Computer Club, but regardless, they're stretching, because that's an aside. Like, that doesn't really have any bearing on whether Manning committed offenses or not. And then the flip side would be that the defense can't describe the sort of harm that did not occur because of the releases, cannot provide that wider context. But I think that the prosecutors have, and in some ways, they're not, I think they're not telling the judge when they, what exactly their intentions are with some of this material. I think that they are more secret and less upfront than the defense. And so they are able to pressure the judge to give them more latitude, because she it's not clear what exactly they're trying to do with some of this evidence.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kevin, explain to us some of the back and forth over acceptable use policy. This is AUP. And as I'm picking this up, this is essentially an agreement that's kind of a codicil to their standard security agreement that anyone who has a high-level clearance must agree to. So tell us about AUP and how it plays into the testimony that was delivered.
Yeah, so what David said, David Coombs, Manning's defense lawyer, said in his objection was that three of the offenses that Manning is alleged to have committed or charged with committing happen to depend upon the terms inside of the acceptable use policy that he signed. And so we're talking about whether he knowingly exceeded his authorized access on the secret classified network, which he had access to on the computer that was connected to that network, in order to obtain information.
Mm-hmm.
So these are computer fraud and abuse. Two of them are Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violations, which for people who are looking at the broader picture, this is that law that they were going after Aaron Swartz under. He, of course, committed suicide after being under an incredible prosecution by the government. So this is a controversial law that many, many people in this country say is used in ways that are far more punitive than intended. And he was challenging this AUP because the prosecutor stepped into court with a sample from a regulation, an Army regulation, and said to the judge that they wanted this to be entered into evidence, and they were going to have this captain, Captain Thomas Cherepko, who was a brigade automations officer in the unit that Manning was in. He was a superior officer and was involved in managing the maintenance of the network. So it would have been his job to monitor whether soldiers were exceeding their access or putting software on their computers that they were not supposed to put on their computers. And they don't have a copy of the AUP that Manning signed. Normally in this trial, you would have the actual document that the person signed, and you would say, he signed the document, and now that he's exceeded access, he violated his agreement. So that gives us the grounds to charge this person and convict him. Well, they don't have it because they lost it. And they also lost the captain's AUP, which I don't know about you. I don't have any evidence to prove that this wasn't anything more than just incompetency. But it does look corrupt from an outside person. You know, mm-hmm. if you're hearing this in a major case, it does seem corrupt. And also it seems corrupt when you have the reality that Manning was detained towards the end of May, and they knew, because they had limited his access privileges to the network, that there was a situation here where they had a soldier who exceeded his access privileges. What were they going to do? Well, they probably should have gotten his AUP out so that they could have that ready when they punished him. And they could have gotten a fellow soldier's acceptable use policy that person had signed, so they have an exact copy of what people sign here. But they didn't secure it. Nobody went to the trouble of getting a copy. I think it's mostly incompetency, but mm-hmm. it does look corrupt from the outside. And so you have this scene in court where Coombs is saying, you can't just enter this sample. It's longer, it's different, it has different terms. And my client, the person I'm representing, Bradley Manning, you can't have argument about these charges, that go to these charges, because you're going to confuse the issue, and it's prejudicial to my to Bradley Manning to have this discussion by using a sample AUP. Now, it got even better. This was bad enough, and it was already pretty contentious. As I say in my report, we had two prosecutors standing at the podium, and you had David Coombs off to the side. So we've got three lawyers standing in the middle of the courtroom going back and forth with the judge. It was one of the more contentious scenes that I've seen of the trial so far. And then when Coombs gets up to cross-examine Cherepko, Captain Cherepko, he asks him about what just happened previously with the cross-examination by the prosecutors. And he asks him about reading the sample policy and how it said something about authorization. And Cherepko can't remember. And so Coombs gets handed this amazing gift because the prosecutors just claimed that he didn't have to have an exact copy of the AUP that he had signed. He could remember what he had signed back in 2009, 4 years ago. And so there wasn't any reason why the judge needed to be concerned about having this witness on the stand making claims about the acceptable use policy that Bradley Manning had signed. Well, he couldn't remember a document that was put in front of him just 10, 15 minutes ago. He couldn't remember it at all. And Coombs, I mean, I even quote him in my post. Basically, he's saying, "You don't recall something you just read a few minutes ago?" "Yes, sir." "Okay, so do you need me to refresh your memory on something you read a few minutes ago?" And if you can tell in his voice, he's being pretty condescending and mocking towards Cherepko, because this is amazing. Just the fact that your witness wouldn't be prepared or would actually conduct himself like this, it could throw the case. I mean, you can really lead the judge to wonder if this witness actually knows what he's talking about.
Very interesting. Kevin, is there anything else? I want to get your comments on some other NSA-related issues, but just is there anything else from the proceedings this week that you'd like to mention?
It's good to transition from this trial into talking about Snowden, and I'll just mention that we've had quite a dip in the people who are covering from the media, and I'm very critical of my colleagues in the press, because I do have an expectation of how I think they should be there, that they should be present. I recognize that some of them were doing some research on Snowden, and it definitely was competing for attention. So we had some people who would normally be at the trial that were following this story throughout the week. And I just want to say that they're both as important. You and I we might get into a discussion. There's been a lot of comparisons between Bradley Manning and Snowden, and I think that in many ways it really is making the issues that people should be focused upon murky, because it's not in making these comparisons, we're not trying to understand these people. It's for some people who want to be able to support Snowden, who need to rationalize how he's better than Bradley Manning because they don't like Bradley Manning, or it's to show that he's the same, that he's not really a whistleblower. He actually did what Bradley Manning did. But in every case, it's not coming from a place of trying to get an understanding of what drives these younger people to want to be whistleblowers and go up against the major institutions that they are members of.
Well, let me ask you to comment on one explicit point, and that is that what we're told is that Ed Snowden delivered the PowerPoint that describes the PRISM program with all 41 slides to both the Washington Post and Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian. Only four of those slides have been published or released in any form. And I was doing an interview in our Boiling Frog series this week with Sabelle Edmonds and John Young, the founder of Cryptome, and they were both highly critical of Greenwald for withholding the release of this information. Now, they're both kind of purists. It's if we've got it, it should be released. And I do understand that there are issues to take into account and that publishers can often get in the way when they see legal liabilities for publishing certain content. But what is your thought about that? Because Snowden apparently got into some sort of disagreement with Greenwald, demanding that the entire 41-slide package be released. And Greenwald seems to be working on his spook bona fides by saying, well, I'm not like Bradley Manning, or I'm not like somebody who would willy-nilly release stuff. We're evaluating this very carefully.
There's a lot to unpack there in what you just said. So the one thing I want people to focus more attention on is the fact that Snowden does say that Manning is a classic whistleblower. I'll get to the meat of your question, but I just think that it's interesting how he did make a comparison between himself and Manning and said he wasn't releasing documents like Bradley Manning, that he had taken more time to go over them. But the bottom line is he still thought that Manning was a classic whistleblower and had revealed information that was in the public interest, just like he was about to do. And he didn't dispute that. So I think the distinction had nothing to do with taking away from the act that Bradley Manning had engaged in. It was more of, let me just tell you what I think about the difference between both of us. And he recognizes that he was going to engage in his act in the shadow of this pariah figure that the government has created in the minds of all of us, which, as somebody who covers this closely, I know that their interpretation is tremendously flawed and in many ways inaccurate. Mm-hmm. But he recognizes that that's a perception of Manning, so he didn't want to maybe experience the same sort of reactions that Bradley Manning had to face. And I can tell in his answers to Greenwald in the interview that he was very concerned about making the mistakes, and I'll say mistakes in quotes, that Bradley Manning made. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to do it better. To your thing about the publishing, yes, I want the full slideshow to be released. And after reading about some of the drama that went on between Barton Gellman at the Washington Post and the publisher at Washington Post tipping off, the editor tipping off the White House or someone in government that they had the slideshow, presumably at the NSA, I would guess. Mm-hmm. But they called somebody and said, we have this slideshow and we're going to publish, figuring out what exactly they were going to hold back and not hold back. And I think that ultimately endangers Snowden. It endangers any source that you're going to be benefiting from having their material. You shouldn't be going to the government. That is one, it just makes you an aider and abettor of the national security state, in my opinion, to use language that the Justice Department would use. Mm-hmm. And also, it's a recognition that you're not willing to exercise your full rights under the First Amendment. You have an absolute right to publish. You should look at the material yourself and make a determination on what sort of risk you want to incur. What sort of attention are you willing to invite from the government? How far out are you willing to go in order to give people information? If there's names of people, if there's methods that you don't want to reveal, if you just want to reveal the general sense, if you don't want to reveal personal identifying information, I think that's perfectly fine, but we should still get the meat, the full understanding of the documents that you are about to release. And that's because your source has come to you and taken a risk, and he wants you to publish the full set of material. That's why Bradley Manning ended up at WikiLeaks. It's the only place that was willing to, well, first off, he couldn't get Washington Post or the New York Times to accept his material, but he knew that WikiLeaks was going to publish it all if they had it. They weren't just going to pick and choose some of it and the parts that they weren't really interested in, they would maybe throw away, and they're going to put up all of it so people can read the full set of documents. And I think that there's something going on behind the scenes with Guardian, and they're still working over material. Snowden claims that there are more documents. I hope to see those. I'm not sure what's going to happen next. I'm not sure what kind of duty the Guardian feels to Snowden as he's out isolated in Hong Kong, wondering if they should release material because it could help aid in his prosecution or his pursuit. Maybe they're hoping he could get to a place of more safety before they release more material. I don't know, but I agree with you and the issue that came up in that podcast that people, we should not just have four of these 41 slides. I doubt that the other 37 are that detrimental, or, you know, they don't probably contain like nuclear weapons secrets or anything like that. So I think that it's probably something we should be able to read.
Well, and presumably, since the NSA has already investigated and determined that Snowden spirited the material out on thumb drives from the Booz Allen Hamilton office in Honolulu, they should know exactly what he has and should assume that most of that has been supplied to Gelman and to Greenwald. And we're seeing them take preemptive steps. For example, General Alexander keeps telling us that there are dozens of cases where these programs have disrupted terrorist attacks on the United States and around the world. He uses the term dozens and then dilutes the universe by saying that it could be anywhere. So far, that is a claim with not zero evidence. They use the Zazi case, but they re-narrate the events in order to try to prove their point. And then we had outgoing FBI Director Mueller up on the Hill claiming that if we had these unconstitutional programs before 9/11, that they would have prevented it. But that contradicts the more credible assertions of Tom Drake and other NSA whistleblowers that if they had been able to do their work without the attempt to outsource Trailblazer to corporate entities, that they would have been able to stop 9/11. And when I look at the credibility of Drake or Mueller, I give the advantage to Drake.
Yes. I absolutely do as well. I don't want to go into too much detail, but I'll also just mention, along with what you've said there, that they're bringing up this Mumbai plotter, this David Headley, and have thrown that around. And he was the government's informant. So they're talking about, and I think you can go, there's a good piece up on ProPublica. My colleague Marcy Wheeler, who does some good blogging, went into some detail about how it shouldn't be anything to celebrate that they would have been able to go after this individual. There's much more to this case that we shouldn't get into here because it's just a big tangent. But yeah, there's no proof, and that's the main thing that people should understand. And so if the Guardian has documents, and if the Washington Post has documents, they absolutely should publish. And they should publish because if we have those out there, we can all talk about them. And if we do think that there are ways that the administration of Barack Obama and these other agencies are coming after Snowden, and we think that it's wrong, we can have the contents there as part of our argument. We can say, look, you know, it's not just those programs we had in the early. It's not just PRISM. It's not just this renewal order for call data from Verizon. We've also got this. This shows that this is the force of hackers that the NSA has attacking China, and this shows that this is they've got special fiber optics. And, you know, who knows? We can only imagine what sort of Stasi-like programs they happen to have ongoing that we just haven't really gotten to see yet. It really is the tip of the iceberg. You even had an elected official in Congress admit that what they saw in their classified briefing was, you know, what we've been hearing publicly is just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, and the Congress that President Obama said was fully briefed got briefed this week, many of them for the very first time. Kevin, we will continue to monitor the trial of Bradley Manning, and we hope to talk with you every Friday with a weekly recap. And, of course, we will continue to follow the summer leak program that has been started by Ed Snowden and see if Glenn Greenwald does follow through in releasing all of the documents that Snowden has provided. And we'll continue to watch your daily live blogging at FireDogLake.com.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
And now, San Francisco stand-up comic and sit-down satirist Will Durst offers his thoughts about the latest leaks regarding the NSA.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few choice words on the revelation that the National Security Agency is monitoring pretty much everything we say all the time. And to be perfectly honest, anybody who didn't already suspect this kind of snooping was going on is not to be trusted with knives in the kitchen without the protection of a fencing mask. Privacy is so 20th century. Unfortunately, while testifying in front of Congress, the NSA insisted that no, they aren't collecting data on Americans, when what they really meant to say is yes, they are collecting data on Americans. Confused by the question is all. Spokesman James Clapper claims he gave the least untruthful answer possible. Just a twist of fate that the least untruthful answer is identical to a bald-faced lie. Then again, even Congress knows that getting a straight answer from these guys is harder than bending a wire coat hanger into a number representing pi to the sixth digit with your teeth. See, the problem is nobody knows who the enemy is anymore. For all our government knows, it could be you or me. Mostly you. Narrowing suspicion is too time-consuming. Much easier to wiretap the entire nation than trying to pick out one or two of us. And what's more democratic than spying on everybody? The process is called data mining, and we, the soft quarry, are producing up to a billion records a day, which is real similar to pulverizing Everest, then sifting through the rubble for the blue pebble. They say we have no reason to worry because even though they're monitoring everything, nobody's actually listening to it. They just like to collect stuff. So this whole thing is just an extra long government-subsidized episode of Hoarders. Besides, the Constitution only safeguards us from unreasonable searches. Considering today's technology, that only protects the dead. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
I'm always grateful that you've listened all the way to the end of this podcast. And here's what you get. Roy Rogers hopping on Trigger.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.